92, daughter and local TV anchor Melanie Lawson is among his four children, known to generations of Houstonians as a preacher and a trailblazer for equality. Lawson helped found Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church in Third Ward. The church began with 13 members in 1962 and has grown to more than 12,000 members today. Call 713-526-5738 now and support KPFT's Fund Drive. We're asking you to call today, and when you do, become a monthly sustainer. It's quick and easy to set up, and your monthly pledge of support takes us closer to our goal. Call 713-526-5738. And thank you for listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston.
Looking out a dirty old window, down below the cars in the city go rushing by. I sit here alone and I wonder why.
Welcome to Growing Up in America here on KPFT 90.1 FM Pacifica Radio. This is a discussion on our children, public policy, and how we do as a city and a community when it comes to taking care of all of our children. Growing Up in America is a production of Children at Risk, the voice of Texas children, a nonprofit organization dedicated to research, public policy, law, and collaborative action on behalf of Texas youth. With you today is Claire Dutre, joined with
Linda Cortado. Hi, Claire.
Hi, how are you in the sunny El Paso today?
I'm great. I took some time off. My sister was in town for Mother's Day, so it was really nice to be with family.
So nice. What are the El Paso hotspots you always take someone to?
Well, there's actually cool little vineyards around New Mexico, and we went to a mineral bath spring too, so it's really fun.
Oh, wow. When I make my trip out there, I'll be on the Linda itinerary.
Okay, great.
Perfect. I actually fail always when people come and visit Houston. I panic and forget everywhere I've ever been. So maybe our listeners can call in one day and let us know if we'll have a segment around it. But for this show, we have our regular segments like thumbs up, thumbs down, data of the day, which our teaser number today is 5%. Do you have any guesses, Linda, on what 5% could be pointing to?
Maybe 5% of kids who get homeschooled in Texas.
That's a really good guess. I echo that. I've seen the answer and I can't get it out of my head. So I'm not going to spoil it for listeners. I know I put it on the document, so I couldn't help it. But in addition to finding out what that 5% number points to, we have some great guests and topics as always. We have Mario Hendrickson with the director of community engagement and partnerships at ELQN through the East Harris County Empowerment Council. We're really excited to talk to him later on. Monica Romo, Garasol Senior Program Coordinator out of UT Health. Jennifer Wolf Williams, the Executive Director of Humanitarian Outreach for Migrant Emotional Health, or HOME. And then Caroline Roberts from Children at Risk to talk about the Latino Health Initiative. So before we get into those wonderful guests, we're going to have a regular thumbs up, thumbs down segment after a short break. So for our thumbs up, thumbs down topic, I feel like we are having topics that are very one way for me and you, but maybe one day we'll disagree. But today's topic is if Texas should implement a universal pre-K program, even if it means increasing taxes across the state.
Linda, I think it's so important for kids. You know, I always talk about being a bilingual student early in elementary school and how I could have been a lot more successful had I gone to pre-K and had more of a diverse experience growing up. So I think it's just so positive for all kids, right?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the research points to it, and we're seeing in the state interim charges a conversation around early literacy and numeracy. And a lot of conversations I've had, even with those folks at the high school level, advocacy or just in the weeds, really point to we need to look down the pipeline and not necessarily just at the end, because kids are, we're not catching it a lot earlier on. I mean, we know that. They predict incarceration rates from third grade reading scores. When I found that out, it made me both very mad and very scared for public education. I really always advocate for the importance of starting from as soon as they're born on the way up. But universal pre-K, we've seen the impact. And yeah, I'm all for it, especially when it comes to emergent bilingual students.
Right. And I think, you know, when you look at that and think about increasing taxes for all Texans and what that would mean, it's just so important for us to see children's education as an investment for our futures, for our economy, for our community. This is exactly the kind of investment Texans want to be making.
Right. And I know we talk a lot about childcare and childcare deserts. And so anytime that we have or expand access to our early learners, it expands more workforce opportunities. And we've done the research and we see that it only boosts our economy. And like you said, it's sometimes I feel like when taxes thrown into the conversation, people back away sometimes, but we need to really zone in on what the long-term investment looks like and really what our humanitarian responsibilities are, just as citizens, neighbors, friends. So we are, I think, both 2 to 7 thumbs up if we had more hands on universal pre-K in Texas. But speaking of early learners, we are excited right after the break to speak with an expert in that space, Mario Hendrickson, Director of Community Engagement and Partnerships at the East Harris County Empowerment Council. On with us now to talk a little bit about the early, wait, I'm going to mess it up, the Early Learning Quality Network in Harris County. Is it Mario or am I mispronouncing?
Mario.
Mario, awesome. How are you doing
Yes.
today to start off?
I am doing great. How are you?
We are well. I don't know if you were listening in, but what is your, I guess I can assume, but opinion on universal pre-K programs?
Absolutely. I think it's critical and much needed. And I think Linda already said it, it's an investment into our community to make a better society. So I think we should all want education and literacy as early as possible for our children.
Yeah, awesome. Again, another 2 thumbs up for it. We'll take it to the state. But Mario, we're excited to talk about what's happening in Harris County. Can you first give an overscope of what you're doing at EHCEC?
East Harris County Empowerment Council, we're probably the largest nonprofit that specifically services the east side of Harris County. And I heard you say earlier about childcare deserts. So the east side of the county is a desert as far as resources in general. So we kind of do a little bit of everything. We do food and clothing distributions, rental and financial assistance when we have it. And one of our exciting initiatives that we're partnering with Children at Risk in Harris County is the Early Learning Quality Network. And what this program is, the phase that we're in now, you know, a lot of times we get funds from the state or feds, and you know, we sit together as professionals or experts and we determine how the money should be spent. For this initiative, it was very important for us to go out into the community to speak with childcare providers, families with children, home providers, and community stakeholders to say, what are your needs as it relates to quality childcare in East Harris County? And the first step, we've been doing focus groups, listening sessions, and a survey to help us gather that information to hear directly from the stakeholders and the families that have children in childcare to say, what are your critical needs? How can we assist?
Which of your programs do you feel have the highest demand And how do they specifically address the needs of the community?
That's a good question. I think every program that we have, I know this is going to sound cliche, but every program that we have is in high demand. One of the ones that the top one is childcare. I would say the top two are childcare needs. And a lot of families are struggling with being able to provide those basic needs, food, clothing, and shelter. So we get a lot of requests for rental and eviction assistance, unfortunately, and childcare. I was just looking through some of our survey results before I started, and cost for families seems the number one strain. We had a recent session at Sheldon ISD at Garrett Elementary School, and one of the mothers were saying she and her husband had to make the decision for her to quit work in order to be a stay-at-home mom because they couldn't afford to send all children to childcare. So that she had to resign from her job for them to be able to afford to send one child to childcare.
Yeah, Mario, what I love what you spoke of is instead of sitting as experts looking at data and making assumptions that could very well align, but ultimately are assumptions based on where we stand, this is an initiative to go to the community. It's exciting because thinking of, it seems like a no doubt, right? We talk about school budgets, but how often are those that are directly impacted, especially down to the students, brought into those conversations? It's always an assumption of let students and teachers do their job. They don't understand this work when that is what's affecting. What have you seen from these conversations in the survey that has aligned with what our trajectories are in the work and in this space? Mm-hmm. And what do you feel are you hearing that isn't necessarily brought up as much that parents and community members are emphasizing?
I think when we went into it, we kind of broke our survey down into specific high need areas that we thought would probably come up, such as technology, health and nutrition, safety and security, and affordability. And it's kind of right where we kind of presumed it would be, especially as far as affordability. And it's amazing that even when we look at kind of we're close to Humble, but that's not our service area, but it's kind of right on that border. And the difference in childcare costs just a few blocks over or a few streets over because of the income, right? So if you have childcare facilities that are able to charge higher because the families can pay higher, then you in turn get more qualified staff. You get staff that stays versus child care providers have stated, well, we need more money, but we know if we charge more, our parents won't be able to afford it. So that means they have to pay their staff a little less, which means they're having trouble keeping staff because they go to higher paying jobs, and keeping having staff that is certified and trained in early child development because just of the low rates that they're able to pay. So it's been really eye-opening and interesting to really hear the feedback from providers and families about what their needs are. You know, it always is one thing to read a statistic, but when you're able to hear the actual story and the emotion coming from individuals who are currently experiencing some of these things, it's really an eye-opener.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's what the big divide is, I think, between a lot of issues in Texas. It's like the reality, the stories, and what you're pushing for. What are those stories? What do you wish more Texans, especially Houstonians, would understand about childcare?
That it really is. Childcare is a early childcare is really an access point to other basic needs that families have because they're able to build their community and learn about other resources that are available. I've heard from some families that they are struggling to provide meals after, you know, at home. Some of the childcares are able to subsidize and send the kids home with a sandwich and fruit every day or just something else besides that. So it's really a good entry point into things such as socialization. I heard y'all mention earlier about dual language learners. That's very important. Just that socialization piece, early literacy promotion. It really goes into a gamut of things. So I think it is so critical. I was listening to, you probably have heard, the federal government offered a supplemental summer program for SNAP, to provide additional funds. Texas was one of the states, unfortunately, that did not accept it. But to hear that a childcare provider is able to send kids home with a small packaged meal, like a sandwich or a fruit, I didn't know that was a thing. Because, and they're doing that because they know the families have a need.
Right. And also women empowerment, right? I mean, the stories you've also shared, it's there's such a strong correlation between providing childcare and getting women to work and empowering women in their spaces, right?
Yes. And yeah. I've heard a lot of comments mentioning funds for going back to school to get that early childhood or early development certification to increase retention of staff. And it makes, you know, a better environment, learning environment for the children.
Yeah. Something I always like to ask guests similar in your expertise, Mario, is when we have these conversations for listeners across Houston or even across the state, and when we talk about an investment in childcare, and for those that don't have children or have children way out of that need childcare, what does it mean for the city? What does it mean for the state when we all invest into childcare centers?
Oh, I love that question. That's me. I don't have any natural children, but I have mentees, I have nieces, nephews, younger cousins. And those, that early investment turns into the middle schooler who took part in our financial empowerment workshop a week ago that we did at San Jacinto College. And that middle schooler turns into a high schooler that wants to further their education outside of high school, whether that's a traditional four-year path, learning a trade or certificate, becoming an educator or advocate in this space. When young children are educated, they are much more likely to turn into young adults and high school graduates. First of all, they're more likely to graduate high school and turn into people who want to better their society and further their education, whether that is through the traditional path or through a trade or skill, which is all needed. So when it starts young, I also am an adjunct professor at Chamberlain University, which is a nursing college. And I always ask my students, what made you want to do nursing? And so many of them always say, when I was young, I had a teacher, or since kindergarten, I wanted to be a nurse, or, you know, in first grade, I had a nurse at the school. It's always connected back to that early childhood stage.
Yeah, I love that answer. I feel like it's a route we don't hear a lot go the route of those parents can get back in the workforce and invest in the economy, which is true. But yeah, just the recognition that we really have those formative years when we're children. So putting someone in that space of thinking of their own formative years and how different it could have been if they did or didn't have access.
Yes. So
we'd love to have you back on. I know our time is a little short, but in the last few moments, yes. If there was a group of representatives right now having conversations, who would you recommend that they bring to the table that is often left out of the conversations?
I would say the providers, and maybe even more impactful, the families, because when you hear the pleas and the cries from the families that are saying, you know, we are so glad that somebody is coming to hear our voice, because they often feel left out. They often feel decisions are made for their community without that direct community impact. So I would say reach out to the families who actually have children in childcare, or who cannot send their children to childcare because it's unfortunately become unaffordable for many families.
Yeah, awesome. Like I said, we'd love to have you back on, especially about that financial literacy course in middle school, because that's exciting to me especially. So awesome. Well, thank you, Mario. And we really hope to, again, amplify to listeners the work that East Harris County Empowerment Council is doing for East Harris County.
Thank you so much, Claire and Linda. It was great meeting you. I hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
After the break, we will have Monica Romo joining us from Girasol out of UT Health.
Y aprovechame hoy, que mañana me voy, y no sé cuándo vuelvo.
Thank you, Monica Romo, for joining us today. Monica is the Girasol Senior Program Coordinator. I'm a big fan. Monica, just share a little bit more about the Girasol program and your mission.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me on. It's really nice to be here today. So HIDASOL, we are actually part of the Texas Institute for Child and Family Wellbeing at the School of Social Work at UT Austin. And we are a small program, but our mission is to provide trainings, consultation, and resources to build a network of trauma-informed professionals that support immigrant families. And so we do that through our three different program areas. We have our training and consulting program, where we provide training and support to legal, social, and mental health professionals that provide services to immigrants in our community. We also have our mental health collaborative, in which we provide mental health assessments to support the cases of asylum seekers and other immigrants that are going through the process of trying to gain status. And then we also have our detention response team, which is where we bring together groups of students and UT to do border trips. And we used to go to detention centers, but we haven't done that since COVID.
Yeah, Monica, I love the work that you and your program are doing. For listeners tuning in, I always look through the education landscape, because it's usually the first epicenter that people encounter when they come to Texas or come to America. When you talk to educators or those in childcare centers adjacent to schools, what are the first three things or first few things you try to communicate to them when it comes to newcomer students coming into their classroom as it pertains to trauma they might have experienced before coming to that school?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, I try to talk to them about the fact that, you know, these kids have gone through a lot, not just in getting here, but even before they left their home country, right? I mean, the reason they fled is probably because something was not going well for them. And I also really ask them to consider the fact that they're experiencing trauma, you know, as they're in the classroom, right? Because for a lot of kids, this is going to be the first time that they are in a school setting, or it's going to look completely different than anything they've experienced before. It's very scary for them to be, you know, all of a sudden, you know, asked to sit in a classroom all day surrounded by children that might not speak their language, with adults that they don't know. So I always ask them to keep that in mind and just to look at the behavior, whatever behaviors or things that they're observing, through the lens of, you know, being trauma-informed and understanding that maybe those issues or difficulties that come up in the classroom are a symptom of, you know, the trauma that they've experienced.
I've been in sessions with you before, and you mentioned this program called Un Rayito de Luz. Could you explain a little bit more about that? I thought that was such a great effort to help kids, especially after they migrate to the U.S.
Yeah, so Un Rayito de Luz is actually a series of workbooks that we have developed here at HIDASOL. And it started off, when HIDASOL first started, we were really focusing on working with the women and children that were in the family detention centers back in, you know, before COVID, and when those, before those centers closed down. And what we did is that we developed a workbook that was targeted towards the women that were in detention, teaching them not only about, you know, normalizing some of the experiences that they were having, right? Some of the symptoms that they were experiencing as being trauma, but also teaching them about, you know, breathing techniques, mindfulness techniques, ways to talk to their children about trauma. And then we also, a few years, maybe a year after that, we developed a workbook for children that is really targeted for unaccompanied children that are in detention centers. So the same thing, really focusing on explaining trauma in a very child-friendly way, and also, you know, focusing on helping them build skills to cope with trauma, teaching them the language that, you know, they might need to talk about their experiences. And really, you know, we really try to make our workbooks very, very accessible and very easy for these populations to understand, taking into account that, you know, with, you know, not only with children and teens, that, you know, they're not going to want to sit through, you know, reading an 80-page workbook or, you know, something that has a lot of writing. So we try to have a lot of pictures, a lot of activities. The writing is minimal, so there's not like a lot of reading involved, things like that. And we've had a great response when we first had the workbook, the women's workbook was only in Spanish. Now we have it available in English and Quiché. And with the teen workbook, we have it in Spanish, English, and Haitian Creole. And we're hoping to be able to actually translate that into a Mayan language this summer. So it's really exciting. And those are all available on our website for free for anybody to download.
I mean, I also appreciate the coloring book because of language barriers that are experienced in those spaces. So that really creates a more inclusive environment for all unaccompanied minors. And I just want to say, I really appreciate your approach in ORR, right, in that space that kids are in. Because when you think about it, there really is no pause in the trauma, right? It's like leaving, and that's traumatic, and travel, and arriving now at the border, and now being detained. And then from there, it's like trying to assimilate into a new culture and education system. So by really targeting that space, you're trying to kind of give them a pause and a breather to kind of reevaluate what's just happening to them, right? And what's to come.
Definitely. You know, I think that, you know, I always say that I was very naive, right? When I started first working with unaccompanied kids, I worked in a shelter, right? And then I did a child advocacy. And I used to just think, you know, if we can get these kids out of detention, they're going to be okay. Like, life is going to be wonderful. And then I went to work with post-release services, which is working with the, you know, with the kids after their release and trying to integrate into the communities. And then I was really shocked to see that the trauma does continue and the difficulties continue. And yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, with the workbooks, that's something, you know, we did them with the intention for children that are in detention, but they can be used, you know, even afterwards. I oftentimes get emails and feedback about our workbooks from providers that are working post-release and that are just, you know, sharing the workbooks with their clients that are not in a detention setting. And yeah, I mean, like you said, you know, the coloring pages and anything that is there, we try to keep it very self-explanatory to where, you know, even kids that maybe don't speak any of those languages that it's available and they still get it. Like they understand what the activity is and how they can do it.
Monica, something we really like and spoke a little bit with our past guests is storytelling and just really emphasizing and wishing that not just data, but more stories were able to be shared just on the impact of this work and what investment into more services, especially mental health services, and just expanding access to services, of course, across the state could mean. Can you share a story or a narrative of impact that you found through your years of working in this work?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, I've had the honor of working with children, again, just like throughout their journey in immigration. You know, I've worked with kids that were just detained to, you know, kids that have been in shelters for many months and then post-release. And, you know, I think that, you know, what they say is true, right? That it just really takes one caring adult and one person to look up to really help a child. I've had so many cases of, you know, working with kids that have terrible, you know, traumatic histories, but have been able to, you know, find that one person, that one adult that has really take it upon themselves to, you know, provide safety for that child. And I don't just mean like, you know, taking them into their home and providing for them, but, you know, like emotional safety and teaching that child about their self-worth and, you know, their rights. And that has made a huge difference. You know, I feel old now because I'm like, man, it's been 10 years that I've been doing this work. And I think sometimes, you know, about the kids that I was working with when I first started and just imagining what their lives are, right? I think that a lot of times because we are fed this narrative of, you know, income invasion and these people that are just like coming into the country. But the reality is that, you know, immigrant children and immigrant adults are part of our communities in every aspect. And, you know, every day we get to see, you know, if we pay attention, they're everywhere. And, you know, I've also had the pleasure of meeting a lot of adults that were unaccompanied children or migrated here. And now, you know, they're thriving. They have their own families. They have their own businesses. And a lot of times, again, when we look at those stories, we forget that, hey, these adults or, you know, older kids, they came here, you know, unaccompanied or, you know, even with their families, they migrated here, but they're part of, you know, the tapestry of our communities.
Right. And how resilient they are, right? That's been also what I've seen is immigrant kids are just so resilient and have so much to contribute to our communities. Monica Romo at Girasol, thanks again for joining us. And after this break, we'll have our data of the day.
Thank you.
I've been under scrutiny, yeah, oh yeah. You handle it beautifully, yeah, oh yeah. All this shit is new to me, yeah, oh yeah. I feel the living dark is creeping up on me. So real, I'm damned if I do give a damn what people say. No deal, the 1950s shit they want from me.
On with us now to tell us what this 5% means, even though I peeked a little ahead of time, is Dr. Christopher Kulesa. Dr. Kulesa, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
We are excited to hear about this data point. Hopefully good news, but the reality sometimes is pretty dull. But what does the 5% mean?
So unfortunately, it's bad news for this week. It is the percentage reduction in kids playing sports after school or on weekends in the past 5 years, according to the National Survey of Children's Health. So a little bit of good news is we still have more than half of kids participating. So 53.8% of children aged 6 to 17 play in a sports team. But that is down from 58.4% in 2017 and 2018 school year. As a reference, in Texas, we're below average. It's 49.3%.
The number is jarring, and I know the importance of sports and activities. I want to get into that. But was there any reasoning or backing behind it? Because my immediate thought is the cost of sports sometimes. Was that what parents or children were pointing to as reason? Or is it really just the age of technology and we're not going outside as much?
It's a little bit all of the above, definitely costs, right? And indeed, what we saw is a reduction based on socioeconomic status. So there was a much larger decline among income levels that were below the federal poverty level. The reduction for those below was 6.5%, but actually there was a reduction clear across the board, across all income levels, including in the highest income bracket. So, you know, part of it, of course, is what happened during COVID-19, you know, families having to adjust to that and still getting on board with those programs, but also too, just a matter of convenience, transportation, you know, work. Many school districts, their bus policies are such that, you know, buses are leaving before any of these programs can be offered. So it's really difficult for parents to be able to pick their kids up. So there's a lot of different things that are happening with this.
Right. I was about to ask you about access too, thinking that this might be a barrier for many families. What is the importance of these sorts of activities for kids? Mental health, their physical health, obviously.
Of course. So, you know, sports, they teach teamwork and problem solving skills. We see that kids that are involved in sport programs, their cognitive abilities actually increase because of their involvement. And as you mentioned with physical activity, of course, active children are less obese. Overall, you do see better rates of weight among those kids. But also too, one thing to note, you know, when it comes to high school athletes, they are indeed more likely to attend college than non-athletes, right? So, you know, there's sort of this perception that being in athletics, that is a zero-sum game with academics, and that really isn't the case. Indeed, athletics can really help a child really meet their academic goals and objectives.
I'm glad you made that correlation. As a former high school teacher in Texas, sports are, I think, the first thing we benchmark as a school. But there is this common misconception. Sometimes, yes, sports do take a lot of time, but I've heard from so many students how it's often the opposite because you have something that you want to keep and you want to keep that community and keep that outlet you have after school. And because of that, there are grade requirements and there are responsibilities you have to meet in the classroom first. And I saw so many students urgently trying to engage and complete their work and do their best because their coaches still held them to that bar. Some because they couldn't play without it, but also because there were a lot of coaches that were invested in their team and were an ally to the teacher and parent. And so, yeah, I'm glad you made that correlation. What would you say for those similar, I know football again in Texas is our benchmark of the state. But for parents who are worried about the safety and the risk of concussions with some of these sports.
I really wish yoga would be a sport, by the way, but go ahead.
It's still pretty complicated.
So I am going to be very honest with you. So I am a parent that is also concerned about concussion and whatnot. So right now our 2-year-old is in swimming. So he does take swim lessons. So that is very real. You of course don't want to discourage children, but of course there are, you know, rights are different and making sure that you're just doing everything you can to keep your child safe while they are involved in sports and really keeping that communication with their coaches to make sure that they are okay. But I will be very honest with you when it comes to like football and such, that is a concern that I do have. And it's something that should be on the mind of parents, but not everything. I know I'm going to say something in Texas, but you know, not there's more than just football out there too, of course. So.
Yikes. There's baseball too.
Baseball. I am a huge baseball fan, so I completely endorse that.
Yeah, or soccer, it's just your feet. But yeah, and just after school activities in the community of letting your child be outside of the community is important. But thank you. I feel like we turned around this data point and might have convinced that 5% to get outside. So we always appreciate you coming on and look forward to next week.
Thanks. See you next week. Take care.
Thank awesome. You.
Thank you. After the break, we'll have Jennifer Wolf-Williams, Executive Director of HOME, Humanitarian Outreach for Migrant Emotional Health.
So joining us today is Jennifer Wolf-Williams, the Executive Director of Humanitarian Outreach for Migrant Emotional Health, or HOME. Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So give us an intro. What kind of work does HOME do and what's its mission?
Yeah, so our mission is to provide mental health services and specifically mental health assessments for people in the immigration process. And primarily that includes asylum seekers who have recently crossed the southern border, but it also includes others who are still in the immigration legal process and need mental health assessments to support their process as they go through the court system or the USCIS system.
You know, I met you when I was practicing immigration law here in El Paso. And it's such a vital service, especially for persons, asylum seekers who are detained and within that context. So when you do this kind of work, especially providing those forensics reports before immigration judges, for example, how important do you think that work is to the overall outcome of the case?
Well, the studies show that it makes a difference as much as there's as much as 3 times the chance of an asylum grant in asylum court if someone has both an attorney and a health professional helping them with their case as opposed to someone who has neither. So it can make a profound difference.
Yeah, Jennifer, I know one of HOME's services is education, and education specifically to end harmful or psychologically harmful immigration practices. Can you speak to some of those practices and suggestions that you try to continue to educate the state and possibly above the state on?
Sure, absolutely. And our really the 2 places where we have most focused on that so far are detention and the process of entry into the U.S. from ports of entry on the southern border, because those are 2 places where we have seen significant trauma and danger, and it affects children. Absolutely. It affects adults and children.
Yeah. And when you talk about this advocacy, who would you like to be more fired up and a louder voice for these children when it comes to their first experiences that often, I'm getting to her thinking first at school and education systems, but other services that really could be speaking up and making big change for what these detention centers look like?
Absolutely. That's such an important question. And the truth is that all of us as community members have more power than we recognize. We tend to think of government officials as being the ones in power, but really they answer to us. And so when the community becomes a welcoming community, politicians will respond to that. And it takes time and hard work, because so much of what people hear from traditional media sources is negative about immigration. But those teachers or anyone who works closely with affected families and children sees the humanity and recognizes not only the humanity, but the importance to the community and what they can offer to us and how valuable their presence is. So I think anyone who has that firsthand experience is an important advocate.
I mean, such a great point about agency, right? Because so many people, when they think about immigration, feel like it's this big, big mess that only Congress can fix, or only the president can start to try and fix. But in reality, all of us have so much agency. And I think that's why your work is so important, to really understand how the persons that are living in our communities, going to our schools, working alongside us at our jobs, right? How have they all been impacted by the immigration experience here in the United States? You know, as you do your work, what do you wish more people understood about the population you serve?
Well, first, exactly what we just said, that they are valuable and important and that we need them. But there is a period of time in which they really need us. And it's important to for those who are going to be working with children in particular, but all of us, to understand the level of trauma that they have endured and just to be here. And that it's sometimes I question, okay, so how much of that trauma am I going to actually describe to the public? Because it's painful even to hear. But many who flee their countries of origin to cross the southern border and enter the U.S., it's because they've been through severe violence. Even children have seen violence firsthand or experienced it, and some have lost a family member, maybe a parent. Sometimes people disappear because of cartel violence in some places or political violence in others. And sometimes it's extreme poverty and the family's been hungry, and that's there are fewer avenues for those families. But that also is a life-threatening trauma for the child who's coming in with that background. And also, I think it's important for people to recognize the trauma that's inflicted because of policies that make it hard to get into the country and to stay safely. And so one of the things that happens outside ports of entry right now, because families have to apply through an app, CBP One app, and right now the wait time is stretched out to about 8 months for people who are using that app. So if you can imagine, these are highly traumatized families, and they are living in a dangerous area where many of them are kidnapped while they wait. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in some regions, and most of the families that we talk to say they were kidnapped at some point while they were waiting, including the children. And they have been through so much that we could prevent if we simply allow them a safe entry and to make their asylum claims.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because we hear those in the country all the time when something happens on other country soil of what can we do, and perhaps they donate to save the children, or it feels very apart from what we can do. But ultimately, what we can do is welcome these children and families into the country. But I want to go back. You spoke a lot about what it feels like for someone immigrating into the United States, and to help look through that lens of what is the perspective of a country when you're facing these systems of that app or of these detention centers, of these processes. What would you, or what is the conception of the country once faced with just the process alone of immigration?
So are you asking about the perspective of the person who's trying to get in, or the perspective of those of us who are here, and how
those immigrating into the country, what does it say about our country when we've had these systems set in place?
Oh, well, so what that creates in the minds of those who are waiting is a sense of disposability and a sense of rejection, because that's exactly what's happening. If we understand how much danger these families are in while they're waiting, and we still say, nope, you have to wait, what we're saying is your danger doesn't matter to us. And that our fear of the other is more important to us than the very real fears that you're experiencing, where most people in the shelter where you're living have been or will be kidnapped.
Right.
And during that kidnapped, tortured. So it says to them, my life doesn't matter. My community's life doesn't matter.
Such a heartbreaking reality. And I mean, one that I would always see here in El Paso on the border and still do. You know, it is an election year, and doing this kind of work, I would have hoped your work would have looked very differently from a Trump administration to a Biden administration, but has it really?
It has not. And yes. That's been really heartbreaking because we anticipate that our work would shift, that the nature of what we were doing would change dramatically, and we would be able to just help people after arrival to meet their mental health needs in different ways. But we're still at this place of simply trying to create safety.
Right. Which, again, I think underscores the importance of person supporting programs like yours, right? A lot of people think, oh, it's all rosy now, but it actually isn't. And your work is all the more critical. So let our listeners know, how can they support HOME's mission?
Well, I would say that we have a team of mental health professionals, licensed mental health professionals, who are dedicated and committed and ready to go. They have a lot of expertise. Most of them speak Spanish and some speak other languages that are needed. And but we want to pay them for their work. And so we always need help with that. And we think it's an important social justice question in itself to pay the people on the ground doing the work. And we certainly need that kind of assistance.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer, for joining us today and sharing more about the critical work that HOME provides for so many migrant families across the border and especially here in the U.S. Thanks again.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And after this short break, we'll return with Caroline Roberts to talk about Latino health.
She went for me slowly, and she pushing up on me, and she act like she know me, and I'm playing alone.
On with this now, last but not least, we have Caroline Roberts, General Counsel and Senior Director of Public Policy for Children at Risk. Caroline, how are you on this sunny Texas day?
Great. I know the weather's been fantastic.
I know the weather is great, conversation not as, but it's important to elevate these conversations for Texas and for the community so we really can get involved. Segueing into, we talked a lot about mental health specifically this episode, a little bit about early childhood learning and health, but we want to talk on the larger picture on Latino health. Can you speak a little bit about the project that you have been working on and some major health disparities you've seen in Houston around Latino health?
Absolutely. So we were commissioned by Precinct 2 to look at Latino health for both children and families. And this is really one of the first kind of comprehensive assessments of the health factors that specifically impact Latino children and families. So we looked at kindergarten readiness, so that early childhood piece, diabetes and obesity, which runs, you know, throughout your entire life. And then finally, mental health, which is something that for many children, although there might be seeds earlier, you're going to see it really start to impact the child in their adolescence. So kind of going through the continuum of a child's development. And although these factors specifically impact Latino children, they also impact all of our children. So what we know is that, for instance, Latino children have a much higher rate of developing diabetes. They also have less access to some of these resources that would help them to be kindergarten ready, to not be food insecure. There's also cultural barriers to something like mental health, as well as access barriers, really, really serious access barriers, particularly for Latino families.
Right. I was going to say the report really highlights these three areas: immigration status, language, and cultural bias. How do you think all of these factors contribute to impacting access to healthcare for kids?
Yeah, so I mean, absolutely. First of all, immigration status. There is so much fear in the community, not just even applying for benefits, but even reaching out to community members. So I think that there has to be personal relationships there. There has to be trust built within the community. And then you have the huge bureaucratic process of applying to some of these programs and some of these benefits. And in some cases, there isn't proper language access. Mm-hmm. And so there are just multiple barriers, first in the fear, then in just the slog, what a slog of a process it is. And then thirdly, in actually being able to read and understand what exactly you're applying for. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you touched on kind of my next question, but looking at this system, I feel like when it starts to grow and grow, especially as just community members, it goes more up, right? So we look more to local and state governments to handle it. And then even they look at these issues in its large slug and don't know where to start. What is one to two things you think should be prioritized that are may not necessarily be easy or quick, but could be the first real turning point towards more access for this community?
Yeah, and I think there are these, statewide or even nationwide systemic things that we need to change, but we will never get anywhere if we don't start with the community, because we won't actually be able to reach these people unless they are working with community members that they trust. And so to that end, I think that our communities have to feel safe and they have to be walkable. We need to have parks that children can play in that are safe and there's transportation to or from or walkable sidewalks. So just improving on outdoor spaces at schools and neighborhoods, community centers, and then having that community outreach. And then another big area, and I'm kind of cheating, I'm combining two, but I think that early intervention, both in kindergarten readiness, but then if we can combine some nutrition education as well into that, even pre-K or kindergarten education, that you were kind of, getting to two ends at once. So we're not only preparing children for a more academically successful future, but also a healthier future.
Right. I mean, that goes back into our data of the day too, right, Claire, where the number of kids participating in after-school activities has gone down by 5%. And the areas that you're touching on, right, like being able to access parks, if they're not readily accessible, is there transportation? And I think just reading through this report and hearing from you, I really appreciate and value the work of our communities and service providers who are really doing the work and trying to combat, even negative political narratives out there. To say this, nevertheless, what you're hearing, we are safe. We do care. You are welcome. And such a critical first step, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Caroline, in this work, what are systems of support you may have not correlated together? Or, I mean, even like sidewalks and parks seem so simple, but are so big in the large picture that you learned really could have an impact.
That's a great question. So one thing that I wasn't thinking of it in this way is the provision of basic needs. Some of the, so like promotoras, for instance, that they are helping people to connect to the needs that they have and how that then affects family stress levels in such a positive way, and it improves mental health. So what we might think of as basic needs, that's having such a profound effect on mental health as well. Whereas sometimes I think that we think of those two things too separately when they're really very intersectional.
Awesome. I know our time is about to be cut short, but we have fun five. I feel like this could be the perfect segue into that and might be repetitive, but could be in your work generally. But what is the most unexpected thing you've learned in your work generally through all your advocacy efforts that you think everyone should know?
Wow, that is such a difficult question.
It's not really a fun fast out of five, but...
There are so many. I mean, there are a couple of things in my job that I've come across and just sort of been like, wow, I can't believe that this wasn't fixed earlier. One example of that is the fact that the vehicle allowance for SNAP was not fixed to inflation. And so people were getting bumped out of SNAP when the car shortage happened. And so they have since adjusted that. That was done last session. So that was one of the ones that really blew my mind. And we have to continuously advocate for things like that as the landscape changes, because there aren't sort of those automatic adjustments happening.
Right. Another hard-hitting question for you, Caroline. What song energizes you for a hard task?
Oh, man. Well, I've been big on Beyonce's new album, Cowboy Carter. So Texas Hold'em is a good get me going song.
I feel like that should be the 89th session theme song. She should come kick off the session and give us maybe a capital performance. The final question is, what was your favorite school lunch? You might have already asked this, but you may have too.
We got a lot of fast food, so not healthy lunches. But I think my favorite was probably chicken nuggets, honestly.
That's a good one, with smiley fries, of course.
Of course, of course.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Caroline, for joining us and the work you continue to do for children. And with that, it concludes this week's show. Thank you to our listeners for listening to Growing Up in America by Children at Risk. This has been Claire and
Linda.
If you've enjoyed our discussion, please tune in every Wednesday from 12 to 1. Oh, we do this each and every week for children.
I hopped off the plane at LAX with a dream, my cardigan. Welcome to the land of fame, excess. Am I gonna fit in? Jumped in the cab, here I am for the first time. Look to my right and I see the Hollywood sign. This is all so crazy. Everybody seems so famous. My tummy's turning and I'm feeling kinda homesick. Too much pressure and I'm nervous. That's when the taxi man turned on the radio. And the Jay-Z song was on. And the Jay-Z song was on. And the Jay-Z song was on. So I put my hands up to play my song. The butterflies fly away. Nodding in my head like yeah. Moving my hips like yeah. Got my hands up to play my song. You know I'm gonna be okay. Yeah. It's a party in the USA. Yeah. It's a party in the USA.
APFT Artist Profile, Jeff Plankenhorn.
Well, I think there's two things that I really, really love about KPFT and about this style of radio in general. One is how good it is to the artist, and two is how good it is to your ears. Because the thing is, these are actual people picking actual music that they dig, that they curate for you to check out. If you turn on KPFT, you might hear one thing in 1 hour and one thing in another. And to be able to come on and say, hey, I'm playing a show, and get to an audience this large, it's just a real gift. And I will go so far as to say this. If you really, really want to help, KPFT 90.1, call 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org, become somebody who gives, who donates, and it'll make you feel good.
Listen for his music and other local artists here on KPFT.
KPFT artist profile, Marcia Ball.
I've streamed KPFT since I could, since I was available and able to do it. And I've also been on Nuri's show.
Yay!
A bunch, the Boss Man of the Blues.
Yes.
And the Blues Hound. It's always been so supportive of the kind of music that I've been playing and that Austin got to be known for. So it was big for me always.
Listen for her music and other local artists right here on KPFT.
Hey, y'all. I'm Anna Lamare. KPFT has been a supporter of my music since day one, and I'm grateful to be a part of this family. Thank you for helping spread independent local music. Support community radio. And this is 90.1 KPFT Houston.